Welcome to Worlds Apart. An old Soviet joke had it that the economy has to be economical, and in the same vein, intelligence needs to be intelligent. The collapse of the Soviet system showed that it was short on both, but in retrospect, it may have been a worthy, albeit very expensive, historical lesson in statehood. As one nation after another implodes from within or collapses under outside pressure, can security services still offer security to the people and do it intelligently? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Rick Spence, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Idaho. Professor Spence, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, I know that you are an expert on secret societies, cults, and intelligence agencies. What do they have in common?
The one thing that all of those groups would have in common is an obsession with secrecy. All right? So the whole thing about a secret society isn't that their existence is secret. Pretty much most of them you know about. Some of them even advertise their existence. The secret part is what goes on inside, because once you join those organizations, you are sworn to secrecy. Mm-hmm. We never talk about what happens. And much is the same in terms of intelligence agencies. It's not like we don't know they exist. It's certainly there. They're usually function as some kind of government agency. But what goes on inside, what they do, the information they have and how they use that information, that's the secret part. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say in another interview that the Russian intelligence services are probably the most powerful in history due to their historical longevity and consistency of performance. What do you think has ensured that consistency, especially given the very, turbulent character of the Russian history, especially in the 20th century?
I've got to qualify that answer in certain ways, because I've taken a certain amount of resistance on that question, because everybody likes to think that their intelligence service is the best. Again, what I meant by that was that over time, one of the things about Russian intelligence services is that going back to the Tsarist era, you have a long history and a continuity between those. So one of the things is that between the Tsarist intelligence services and the Soviet intelligence services, there's a great deal of overlap. Initially, many of the same people were involved because, when the time came to build a new Bolshevik intelligence service, a lot of Bolsheviks really weren't good at spying. They were might have been good things. So who would you find to do that? There's a degree of professionalism within this. So here's an interesting thing to keep in mind. What the Tsarist intelligence services did, the Okhrana in particular, was to combat revolutionary conspiracies. And it did so quite effectively. It infiltrated those organizations. It turned people to become informants. And it was quite good at that. Now, then what happens when the revolutionaries take over? Well, one of the things that the fellow who becomes the first, the real head chief of the Soviet service is Dzerzhinsky. What was he? He was a professional revolutionary. He'd been arrested on something like a dozen times. One of the things that he'd learned to appreciate is that these guys are quite good at what they do. All I need to do is now recruit them and pay them to do the same type of thing, so they will not be searching out revolutionaries. They'll be searching out counter-revolutionaries.
And what's interesting is that one of the first monuments to be knocked after the collapse of the Soviet Union, one of the first Soviet monuments to be knocked down was the monument to Felix Dzerzhinsky. And yet, a couple of years after that, the first democratically elected president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, appointed a former KGB officer to the post of prime minister and later handed over presidential powers to him. I'm talking about Vladimir Putin, and this sort of continuity of the intelligence culture in Russia is really puzzling to me, especially when you consider that ideologically you know, the break is always total. So, for example, the communists used to say that, like, there is no way of turning back to the czarist times. Everything in the czarist times was bad. The same thing happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The, you know, new liberal Russia believed that, you know, all the Soviet experience was totally denigrated. And yet, this trend keeps resurfacing. What do you think explains this institutional transcendence?
The first part of it is the basic utility of an intelligence organization. Now, again, the Soviets needed, they had enemies, internal and external. It wasn't just paranoia. They were in a vulnerable position, and therefore having, you know, the goal of an intelligence agency is basically to do two things: protect your secrets and steal the other guys. Broadly, to create a security of information. So you need that, and you're going, and there are only a certain number of people who know how to do it. If you know, if you need your car fixed, you're going to need a mechanic. So in that case, the particular politics of the mechanic don't really bother you.
If I may, I would add one more thing, and I think that's very specific to the Russian context, because FSB or KGB, they're predominantly masculine institutions, and this is a way to foster a very specific masculine culture in the Russian society that has been depleted of men because of the revolution, because of the civil war, because of the Second World War. So I think that's also the way of essentially protecting and also to some extent cultivating, you know, the good gene pool. And this leads me to my next question. The Americans have long been dismissive and paranoid about Vladimir Putin's intelligence background. But if we put these stereotypes aside, these agencies are capable of producing intelligent individuals. And by that, I mean individuals who possess the ability to process information in a sophisticated, differentiated way, who are, you know, capable of not seeing the world in black and white. Plus, these kinds of institutions also train people to keep their ego in check and prioritize larger national interests. Wouldn't you want to see that in any leader?
George Bush the Younger had an intelligence background, so it's not always the case that
Russian intelligence background. I mean, there's a difference.
Well, not so far as we know. So it's not unusual to. Yeah, Westerners tend to freak out a bit over Putin's intelligence background. You know, it's a kind of convenient thing to do. He had to do something beforehand. But that probably also gives him, well, here's one way to think of it. Ideally, you would hope, okay, this is one of the things we always hope, is that somebody, somewhere, actually knows what's going on. We like to think that somebody has the real information. Somebody knows what's going on. Somebody is in control, because the opposite of that is that nobody is in control. Now, it's nothing but a clown car of fools that are sort of running.
Well, I mean, the American narrative, Professor, is that the people are supposedly in control, even though, I mean, how much control the people have over the governing affairs is, you know, it's a whole different discussion. But I agree with the point, yes, that we do have this need for knowing that there are certain agencies within the government that, you know, keep their hand on the pulse, so to say.
No matter how you feel about them, that whether it's the KGB, whether it's the FSB, whether it's the CIA, that they've got to know what's going on, right? Right? I mean, someone has to know what the real situation is. Now, maybe they don't. Maybe they're just faking it. But the presumption is that if anyone does, it would be them. And it thus gives a kind of tremendous advantage in controlling the narrative, in controlling the story. Everything's a story. History is a story. Politics is a story, and everything is about managing what that story is and how it fits together.
Well, Professor, but if, let's say, the Russian or the Soviet or imperial before that, the intelligence services were so good at controlling and managing the story, why do you think Russia as a state has experienced almost total collapse twice during the 20th century.
Notice what didn't collapse, what always bounced back in each one of those cases. The intelligence services. There is a kind of seamless transition. It isn't even a transition. It's the same thing. Governmental agencies are like organisms. They're bureaucratic organisms. And what every organism seeks to do is to survive and to grow. And they adapt in order to accomplish that. That is the basic way that life operates. You survive, grow, and if you don't adapt, you perish.
It's no secret that President Putin has sought to create some checks and balances within the Russian intelligence services. Perhaps this is just my guess, to prevent any particular group or any particular organization to accumulate too much influence, including over him. And I do want to ask you perhaps a difficult question of what do you think of Putin's handling of this very specific, very secretive instrument of state power?
Since he is an alumnus of that organization, he should have an idea as to how it operates and to the advantages it presents and also to the dangers it presents. Intelligence agencies are probably the prime example of what people mean when they talk about something called the deep state. Now, that's originally a Turkish term and is connected to, among other things, the constant tendency of the Turkish military and intelligence services to overthrow civilian governments whenever it suited them, and to do it again and again and again, which, of course, gives the impression that they're the ones who are actually in control, and they just let the democratic process run as long as it suits their interest. And that impression, I think, was entirely correct. So the deep state, again, goes back to this idea that bureaucratic entities within a state are organisms that seek to grow and survive. And the other thing about them is they're not really, you've got two different levels of the government. You've got elected officials. You've got presidents, vice presidents, senators. You have the people they appoint to head agencies. But those are all temporary. We always know that they're temporary. I had a fellow who worked for a U.S. government agency, not the CIA in this case, but he said that, you know, I really don't pay much attention to presidents because, you know, for the most part, they're going to be here for 4 years, they're going to be here for 8 years, and I'm a career government employee. I'm going to be here for 30 years or maybe 40. So these guys just come and go, and I come to work and do my job every day.
Well, Professor Spence, let me stop you here because we need to take a short break. But before we do that, I think that logic worked a couple of years ago. But with President Trump, you cannot be 100% sure that you or your country or the world will be there in 8 years. So let's discuss it just right after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Rick Spence, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Idaho. Professor Spence, just before the break, we were talking about this logic on the part of deep state participants in the United States that they need to do their job and they don't pay that much attention to, you know, presidents who come and go. And interestingly enough, you know, President Putin also said something similar about the United States. He said that no matter who comes to power on or on whatever platform, you know, that person will get a visit from men in black suits, and those men in black suits will find their way of steering governance in certain direction. Do you think, though, that's still the case with Donald Trump?
Trump is a game changer in a lot of ways. And one of the things I want to avoid here is getting into partisan politics, because the United States at present is a country deeply divided over a lot of things. Let's put it this way. Living in the United States now, from my perspective, is weird. It is surreal. There are things going on that I never imagined would ever go on. There are a lot of things, Chato. There are people who are convinced that Donald Trump intends to make himself a permanent executive. Maybe he does. I'd say that would be, it remains to be seen whether that would be possible to pull off. But part of what he's really good at is generating chaos. And look, generally, wherever he goes and whatever he involves himself in, it becomes chaotic. Now, some people argue that's a strategy. It may be. Others argue it's simply a lack of something. You know, it's just pure chaos. I don't know. I suppose time will tell. But it's not the same old USA anymore.
Absolutely. And I'm sure many people in Venezuela, in Iran, perhaps in Cuba, in many other countries around the world would find the current circumstances weird, as you put it. And, you know, a part of me sort of secretly hopes that, you know, there are those men in black suits representing the American deep state who come to, let's say, the Oval Office if President Trump decides, for example, that a little nuclear strike would be a useful distraction from many conundrums that he faces. Do you think that's a realistic scenario? I mean, putting all the jokes aside, you know, if President Trump or whatever, you know, any other American president decides to use the, you know, very powerful instruments of the American power to, you know, either to stay in office or just to distract from criticism. Do you think there will be somebody in the American deep state who would prevent him or her from doing that?
Well, there are certainly many people who hope so. All right. So again, I'm not going to try to jump in on one side. You know, I would like to think that whether it's in the CIA or some, I don't know, Department of Agriculture, that there is someone who has the best interests of the country and some degree of common sense, which is one of those things that is never really that common, who could intervene. But that means many things. You know, there's intervention. You eventually get into a room with the president and you simply grab him by the lapels and go, look, okay, you're off base. This is the way things have to be. Or does it involve something more serious? What kind of intervention do we have? I think at the present time, a lot of people just don't know. We wake up every day and it's some other thing, right? This is the point I would cross. As much as the Trump administration's actions and words affect the rest of the world, and certainly they do, they affect we Americans as well. We don't know what's going on. And every day is just sort of, you know,
well, maybe,
what's going to happen to me?
Maybe you should ask your Russian colleagues what's going on. Maybe they know, because, you know, here in Russia, we have this new expression, the special diplomatic operation, which refers to how the Kremlin is constructing its communications with Donald Trump, avoiding offensive and pejorative language, even when the situation clearly calls for it. And what I want to ask you is, do you think that's an effective way of dealing with somebody like Donald Trump, trying to at least keep some sort of communication line with him? Because if no one in the American deep state can persuade him, perhaps who knows, you will be helpful or rather grateful for the Russian intervention in this particular case, if President Putin can place a call and perhaps talk him out of some initiatives. What do you think about that?
Here's purely an opinion, which I don't want to sound too political, but the one thing that seems apparent to me is that more than anything else, Donald Trump wants to be in the center of the picture. He likes attention. He constantly likes his name and his face in the news. So dealing with him in that sense, let's say there's a large ego which is involved, and he's very sensitive to what he perceives as any kind of insult to that ego. So the way arguably you deal with a person about that is that you know, flatter their ego as much as possible. You let them have center stage. So the way you're going to work with him, I would say, is not just to go in and tell him that you're wrong, okay, that this is a stupid idea and you shouldn't be doing it. No, that's not going to work. You can say, hey, you know, that's kind of a brilliant idea you had there, but maybe there's an even more brilliant idea. There was a saying about a past American president, Woodrow Wilson, all right? And someone who was very close to Woodrow Wilson was once asked, you know, how you got the president to do something. And their answer to it was that you convince him that by doing this, he will attain an even greater place in history.
I do want to ask you a question about institutional cooperation, because just the other day, the U.S. intelligence community released its threat assessment report for 2026, which holds out the hope that the U.S. and Russia could return to, quote, an improved bilateral, geostrategic and commercial relationship. And as a Russian, I can say that it's very hard to understand what the Americans may mean by a productive relationship, especially in the context of the Iranian and Ukrainian conflicts still raging on. But knowing what you know about the Russian, about the American security agencies, do you think they can have enough trust at this point of time to develop any meaningful relationship?
Well, that's hard to say. And while trust is nice, it's not always essential. You know, one of the things you can sometimes use, as strange as it may seem in a relationship, is to simply recognize that the other side is reliably unreliable. Right?
Well, as long as it's not reliably mad, I think that would be good enough.
It's not reliably mad. Well, again, one of the things that you could, I think, fairly predict about Trump is that, you know, he changes his mind a lot. All right. So what he says one day is not what he's going to say the next day. And we'll go. So in that case, he's reliably unreliable. You know, how do I forge a relationship with someone who I know that I cannot trust their word, that their word will simply change on a whim from day to day? You can do that, but you have to be, well, you have to be adaptable on your own. You have to be, but the essential part of that is accepting the fact that this person, and I have to deal with them, there's nobody else for me to deal with, but they're not reliable. And I must always keep that in mind. Any agreement that they make, they may have no intention of keeping. Mm-hmm.
Now, we have discussed the Russian, the American intelligence agencies. I do want to ask you about the Israeli, because the Mossad has long been considered as one of the most sophisticated intelligence services in the world. It also happens to be the main organization that is now enabling Prime Minister Netanyahu's quite aggressive policy in the region. And there is a lot of sort of half jokes about how they've managed to recruit the U.S. president and his entourage to the Zionist cause. Would you count that as a successful infiltration? Do you think there is any truth to those jokes?
Well, let's be honest. There is some kind of special relationship that exists between the United States and Israel. Okay. The United States is, practically speaking, and always has been, Israel's main protector and enabler. You know, one could argue that it's the Israelis who sort of have, you know, a ring in the nose of the Americans that are always pulling them around. Or others will argue that it's the U.S., which is using Israel as a kind of giant aircraft carrier in the Middle East as a reliable base of operations. I think it's mutual exploitation in that respect. Both sides are useful to each other. This again is a kind of, I think, a key element in intelligence. Intelligence agencies often have to recruit and use people that they don't trust. All right. Suppose you have someone who comes over to you as a defector. They've defected and they come over and they're offering you information. But what's the one thing you obviously know about them? They're untrustworthy. Okay. They just betrayed their original employer and now they're offering their services to you, which means that you will never trust them entirely. But are they useful? Yes. That's all that matters. Not whether they're good, not whether they're just, but simply whether or not they're useful. The United States is very useful. It is absolutely necessary to Israel, and Israel is useful to the United States.
Well, but I think there's also one aspect to this very special relationship, which revolves around, well, you can call it a religious conspiracy. I'm talking about evangelical Christians in the United States who believe that it's their religious duty to make sure that the second coming of Christ, the apocalypse, actually materializes, and they happen to be among these 144,000 people who are saved and the rest of the world can go down in flames. And we could laugh about it, but it's clearly playing a major role in what's going on in that part of the world. And it's that area where your expertise in both intelligence services and, I guess, cults and conspiracy theories combined. Do you have any ideas of how we can, and by we, I mean desperate people around the world who look at it in shock, how this kind of alliance could be, if not stopped, then at least brought to some degree of sanity? Because it seems to be very, very dangerous looking from the outside.
Well, I guess the first question is that are there really people in the U.S. who view themselves as Christians, who see the current war, is it a war? I guess it is, in Iran as the beginning of the Battle of Armageddon. It's the end times. And that this, I have heard this from a person's actual mouth. Okay, they're not in government. But their belief is that this is going to bring Jesus back. And from their standpoint, nothing is more important than that. Now here's an interesting kind of question. How do you reason with someone like that? How do I convince someone? How do I talk to someone who believes that nuking Iran will bring Jesus back? I don't know. I know the person I was talking to is otherwise quite reasonable. You know, they can put their shoes on, drive a car, and do things. Their eyes aren't spinning. They're not an obvious crazy person. But in that particular belief, the only thing that I would have to say, and apologies to anybody out there, that's just insane, right? You have gone selectively mad, which is one of the things that cults do to people in many ways, is I think they make them selectively insane about something. And yeah, that's a very dangerous situation, and we should be concerned about it. In fact, more than that, we should be afraid of it. What can we do about it? I don't know.
Well, Professor Spence, I guess we have to end our discussion on special information and the handling of it on this very phrase, that we don't know what's going to happen. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.